This is the Bookmark Podcast from Scottish Book Trust. If you love books and reading, connect with us at scottishbooktrust.com, on Facebook, and on Twitter.
Hey everybody, welcome to Bookmark. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, and today we have a brilliant episode for you. We stargaze at the Edinburgh International Science Festival. We have a fascinating conversation with Kirsty Gunn about music and literature and making art, and that centers around her recent book, The Big Music. If you haven't read it, go get a copy. Also, Jenny Fagan is on the podcast. Jenny Fagan has just made the list of Granta Magazine's Best Young British Novelists. We sat down with her not long ago, recorded a story in Princes Street Gardens, and we just thought, man, it would be a really wonderful treat to celebrate that great news for Jenny. To share this story with you. I think you're going to really enjoy it. It's pretty mesmerizing. But first, I want to introduce you to Kirsty Gunn, wonderful novelist, fascinating conversationalist. I caught up with her at the Stanza Poetry Festival where she was talking about poetry, and here we talk about her latest book, The Big Music.
The Big Music took me a long time to write. It took me 7 years and then a further year for publication. And like all my work, I didn't know what was going to happen at the end when I started out. And it was really difficult because the book started out with this image of an old man coming to the end of his life, up on the hills in Sutherland, carrying in his arms a newborn baby. And I write this book for 7 years to find out why he's there, who she is, this child, and why he should have her in his arms. So there were points of madness. and then a further year to prepare the book for publication because the book's quite complicated. It's not only a story. It's not only a story about music that in itself, I hope, becomes a kind of musical experience. It's not only a story about a very arcane, esoteric kind of music, Kiel Moore, big music, which is the most serious, grave, and important form of bagpipe music. Very, very beautiful. No, it was made more complicated because the book also comes with its own landscape and world. So it comes with appendices and notes and diagrams and plans and maps and all kinds of kit, which kind of drove Faber completely nuts. I mean, it took a lot of time to organize all these papers and get the whole thing coming together. In a way, I think my fantasy for the book would have been, you know, for it to have been a box. I kind of conceived it when I was first coming to it as a sort of set of files, a kind of millefeuille of papers that would be layered one on top of the other. The reader might somehow rummage through the box.
Not unlike B.S. Johnson or something, right?
Yeah, yeah, that kind of idea. People have such traditional ideas of fiction that are all located with the novel, and that's all coming from the great 19th century novels that are still continue to define how we think about reading fiction. Whereas, of course, you know, despite modernism, despite, you know, everything that's happened, the poor role of fiction still seems to be mimetic and to stuck in the narrative line. But there are all these different ways of approaching stories and storytelling.
Shut up and tell your story.
Quick, quick, quick. Get to the end. What happens?
Which is hard if you don't know how your book's going to end. So in that 7 years, I mean, were there moments of paranoia that where you thought, I mean, is there ever an inclination that you're not going to be able to finish the book?
No, because the sense of commitment to any piece is quite enormous. I think it's this thing. Now, at this point, I often make a lot of enemies, and we don't like using this word in this country, do we? Artist. But I am an artist, you know. I've made a contract with mystery and the unknown, and I am making something out of nothing, and I'm making something that wasn't there before. You know, from the beginning, you're sitting there thinking, what am I doing? You know, at one point, my husband wasn't working, and my daughter was very unhappy at school, and we were moving, and everything was just a great stramash. And here I am working away on this book. Actually, you know, I've been with Faber for years, and they're lovely publishers, and I'm, you know, very at home there. But I actually thought, you know, in the world that we're in, with the, you know, publishing in the state that it's in, I was thinking, Faber aren't going to publish this. You know, what am I doing? No one's going to read it, and yet still, there one is every day working away, getting to the writing. You know,
is there a sense of freedom in that? And when you start to realize that it doesn't matter. I mean, certainly me as a poet, right? Like the idea of it being published is so far removed from my experience of writing the work,
yeah, yeah,
but it's actually kind of freeing because you can go deeper.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that's what I was talking about. That's why I'm always happier with the poets than with the novelists. The novelists, on the whole, have made a contract with the marketplace and with their readers who have certain expectations. The poet, the artist, is just alone, working in this void and creating something that they know needs to be made for its own peculiar raison d'être.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you get music into a novel? How did you tackle that? Was it just the phonetics of it and the movement and the rhythms? Is it just strictly bearing down on the kind of sounds?
Yeah, there's two things going on, and one is the sheer structure of the book, which, as I said there, is based on the pibroch, so that has very kind of formal rules about what happens when and how. It's a music that's created in three to four movements is the basic kind of shape, and then there are variations on those movements, and certain particular things happen within the movements. So once, like, we have the first, which is the erla, which is the ground where you're laying down your themes and ideas, and then we have the tuala, which is in a way the first major variation, but is also a kind of departure from the safety of those themes. While also looking back at it, there's a kind of sense of leap. We talk about this idea of a stag's leap into vacancy, you know, the tuala. And then there can be variations within that. Then we have the krunla, which is the crown, where we start to embellish and develop and embroider those themes that were established in the erla and then subsequently in the tuala. And then we have the krunla amach. Krunla means crown. Amach is to refer to the making of that crown. So it's this beautiful kind of reflexive movement. And it's the point at which the piper, who up till then has been walking up and down, playing with this very steady kind of beat of his tread, will then stand and bow his head as he then plays the most complicated part of the music. And this is to show his own expertise as a player, but it's also to expose the music's making. And then we return at the end of the music to the erla. The beginning is the end. But I have a krunla amach movement.
And what would that be?
Where we start to expose the book's makings. We start to find out who it is who's put this all together and where it's come from. And there's a sense of resolution about how the whole project has come into being.
When you set yourself the task to formally create the book in this manner, did you know exactly what you were getting yourself into?
The thing is, it's so arcane and esoteric. And as I said, you know, been brought up with the pipes, and my father, you know, is a fine player and knows many fine players, so it's always been around and obviously talked about. But for all that, as I said to someone recently, or someone said to me, it's a bit like Finnegan's Wake. You know, you just think, all right, I've got it. I think I understand what you mean. You know, this is after some 3-hour conversation with my father about the jithi variation, and you walk away thinking, yeah, I think I've got that. I'll put, you know, make some notes for the book. And then 2 minutes later, bang, no, I know nothing at all. It is like reading Finnegan's Wake. I think you've got it. Back to the beginning.
Kirsty Gunn, everybody. Her novel, The Big Music, is available everywhere. Every 10 years, Grantham Magazine compiles a list of what they consider to be Britain's best young novelist. 10 years ago, that list included people like Alan Warner, A.L. Kennedy, David Mitchell, Sarah Waters, you know, names that a lot of people respect and certainly are well known. This year, we were really pleased to see that Scottish novelist Jenny Fagan making this list. And so we have this story from her, in which I think gives you a pretty good idea of exactly why she's on that list. We recorded it in Princess Street Garden, so you'll hear a little bit of background noise. But I think the story itself is fantastic. It's a bit gristly, so if you have young listeners or if you're of a sensitive disposition, there will be some language. There will be definitely some scenes of uncomfortableness. So you might want to skip ahead if you happen to be sensitive. But if you're not and you want to hear something fantastic, ladies and gentlemen, Jenny Fagan.
This is a short story called Impilo, which is based, there's a character who comes back to Edinburgh. I won't tell you anything more about it. And Impilo means life in Dabeli. And it was actually based upon, that part was based upon a newspaper article I read about a hospital in Zimbabwe that was burning limbs because they didn't have the funding to dispose of the limbs correctly. Anyway, I fall backwards into the screech. The lawnmower blades whir once, twice, then gouge into flesh. Muscles sever, bone cracks and splinters, the sky turns white. The motor snarls. Its jagged steel teeth rip into sinews, tear at globules of fat and gnaw tissue ragged. Blood arcs slowly up into the vast, bleached-out, airless nothing. Daffodils nod their heads quietly. The lawnmower sputters to a halt. Silence. I am falling. In the kitchen, I see Emma put her mug on the draining board. She looks up and covers her mouth. Between us on the lawn, the mower's blades still grind round, all spattered in blood and raw lumps of meat. My leg spurts out blood and the severed shin and foot no longer attached. Emma is running down the small back hallway. Her bare feet thud off the creaky old floorboards. My severed leg struggles upright. It half turns around to where I lay, gasping at it. Then it lurches frantically away towards the rosebush. The ankle is purple. Flesh curls away at the calf. One clean shard of bone stabs out the top. The back door whacks open. Emma unwinds her headscarf frantically as she runs and skids down onto her knees. The toes of the leg wriggle at me. It's gonna do a tap dance, I moan. No the fucking day it's no. Emma rapidly winds her scarf around the stump below my knee. Tight, so tight I can feel it through the pain screeching up through my body. The leg hops further away from us. It wavers on the edge of the decking before catching its balance and planking itself firmly down. It bleeds all over the brand new deck that Emma laid for me coming home. My heart hollers. The leg tap dances across to an old cracked mirror behind the peonies and admires its reflection. It turns this way and that to see every bloodied angle. Emma creeps up slowly behind it. She lunges, but it bounds out of her reach and pogos furiously through the wild garlic patch by the bin, then it shuffles right underneath the rosebush. Just the toes stick out. Emma pretends to have lost interest and it doesn't move. She whistles, looks at her nails, then she turns quick on her heel and launches herself at it, grabbing the thing with both hands. It wriggles as she stands up and holds out before her as she marches inside. Emma brandishes the phone at the kitchen window, but I shake my head furiously at her. She won't do it. She won't hand me over. We both know. I can't take any more time. I'm not going back to jail. We don't need a doctor here. Emma comes back with a doobie. Then there is a pulling, thuds, my sweat slick and cold, and the building roar of white noise. I see my dead dog with a leg in its mouth. It runs off through the gate, runs towards the cliffs, the sea. Everything recedes. Time leaves. It will have no part in this. I am laid out in the kitchen on the checkered linoleum. Emma grabs a rubber hose, snaps it round my arm and yanks hard. She lays out her beach towel, a bottle of gin, her needle kit, some skag, water, morphine she said she didn't have, and a saw. She bubbles up the skag in a teaspoon like she'd never stopped. I thought she'd stopped. It's okay, she whispers as she flicks the needle repeatedly, finds a vein and pushes the stopper all the way in. Warmth floods through me. She lifts my thigh and leans it straight up against the fridge freezer to slow the bleeding. The wall is smeared red-brown with blood. My other leg is folded up against me until I am a half-lotus. She is beautiful, so we float. Emma strokes my hair. A black, starless sky whirls through the kitchen door keyhole and drags its weight across me. Emma shrinks. Through a tiny pinprick of light, I see her reach for the saw. I'm on the train and it's yesterday and the world is far too wide. Emma, 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 the train chugs. As the train crosses the border, the windows rattle. Wehey! Escape? The tea lady asks me, coffee pot poised. I look out the window at cliff tops where seven dead girls sway, just like they hung in their cells. Each of them grins widely and waves me on my way. Thank you. Yeah. The tea lady pours and shuffles on her way. In a morgue, the seven suicide cell girls rub at the red marks around their necks. They snap vertebrae back into place, look at each other and nod. She wouldn't have survived much longer, they say. I couldn't do another 2 years, the youngest adds. You couldn't do another 10 minutes, her sister sniggers. Mercy, mercy, they murmur, as the morgue man comes to drain their fluids away. The train smells of beans, it smells of floor, it smells of smelly old man. It does not smell of metal, keys, doors, linoleum, bleach or despair. I will not go back. I won't make it if I do. I get out at a train station I have not seen for 10 years. The marble floor echoes. It seems to ripple like water. A raggedy pigeon hops by. It has one red eye and a slicked up grease of feathers like a mohawk. The red eye is oozing pus. It looks like one claw is knurled up, almost growing back into its leg like some weird tumour. I run up the back steps of the station, air burning at my lungs, out the exit and past some homeless guy, round the corner, and she's there, and she kisses me again and again. Her hair smells like coconut. I can't stop smiling. This is everything I want. The 9-hour drive to the cottage is me taking in her silhouette, her hands on the gear stick, driving like it's so easy. Her laugh, light and nervous, our words of mush rolling over each other, saying nothing, saying I love you, I am here, you are here, this is us again. The cottage is 60 miles away from anywhere. The forests are holy. The fields and gates and earth and skies and brooks and stiles and rabbits are holy. Tomorrow I will mow this holy lawn. I will love Amma every single day. Bits of bone, cartilage, dropped into the bucket, towels soaked bloody, tissue. Clean gauze soaks in, yellow fluid seeps out, another needle, more haze. I don't know how many days have passed when I wake. There's a knock, 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 knock from the porch. Knock, knock, knock. Walking sticks getting rattled over, welly boots, boots flung around. That limb was never so active on me. It's like having a puppy. What do you want to do with it? Amma asks. Build a fucking bonfire. She takes it up to the bathroom and bathes it in the sink. She reckons I have to say goodbye to it, that I have to take a wee look. Or it'll itch and ache, she calls down the stair. I look up at her and she smiles. I saw it in a documentary. There were these people, amputees like, saying goodbye to their limbs on a cushion in a chapel. It helped them accept what had happened. Quite clever, eh? And also there was a hospital called Impilo in Endabeli. That means life. Eh? They just had to burn all the extra limbs there, though. Heads, bodies, the lot. Lack of funding and that. She is sat on the chair at the top of the stairs, patting the leg dry. She knows I'm watching. She sat there with her dressing gown open, trying to catch my eye a million times before this all happened, before I went away. Chanel Black, she offers as she concentrates, paints each nail carefully. Suddenly, I miss my fucking cell. Amma says burning it should be a celebration. What is there to celebrate, Amma? Celebrate you ever had it in the first place, she says slowly. She is clearly insane. I can smell rotting on what's left of the meat around my kneecap, but she's sewn it up neat, I'll give her that. Amma says the smell's all in my brain. Toes dried, she wraps a silk scarf around the top of the limb. She cradles it carefully and pads down the stairs, barefoot, bare-skinned, kimono flowing. She sits the leg down on a velvet cushion on the table. She has put some glittery shit on it. I wonder if that scarf is long enough to strangle her with. She would look beautiful, strangled. Look, she says as she lights candles. I sigh. I look. Despite the glitter and the Chanel nails and the velvet cushion and the candles and her sitting with her tits out like, as soon as I need some, she's there. Despite all the ceremony, that leg looks queasy to me. It looks like it's in drag. Amma photographs the leg with her digital Nikon, and I remember when she took Polaroids. It's not art, I state. It's all art, she replies. Every breath you inhale into your cells, all multiplying and dying and recreating, it is all art. Like shit in a tin, it's art. She snorts and begins to laugh so hard she glows, and I want to kiss her, but first I'd have to punch her, and I can't get up yet by myself. Amma's knocked me out some good ones. She trapped my head in the front door once, just trapped it in there, my eyes bulging, shouting, screaming, but that was then is not now. Now I couldn't touch her wrong, no matter how much I might feel like it. I wake as Amma is lacing a daisy chain anklet around the leg. Your barometer of normal is fucked. I never did do normal, she says. She's not lying. She never did do normal. She did other stuff, like the piercings through her lip and her chin and her clit and that. She did them by herself as well, sealed the wounds with almost boiling salty water. She's got amazing, delicate, ornate wee flower tattoos trailing down her belly, round her waist, ornate on her tiny feet. She's lived on a barge, in a shack, a cave, a commune. She's lived in the forest on a platform on stilts where bison ran below each night. A teepee for 3 years until she was 23, and then she got left the cottage and it was here she brought me. This place is for us, she said. She lavished it with love and made everything grow wild and tall and beautiful, even me. I shouldn't have tried to cut the grass. I shouldn't have had a gin before breakfast. I shouldn't have let Amma meet my mother in 83. My mother looks at her like she was some kind of disease made up by some kind of being no one's even heard of. Amma took it like a real big compliment. Amma isn't keen on normal as an idea. She says that normal is just something they bludgeon you guilty with. She says we're raised to think that normal is a real thing, so we police our thoughts and our actions for any aberrations that could outcast us. Amma says that's just how the system wants it, so people keep giving them their money and just shut the fuck up. She made stew last night. Greens out the garden, rabbit out the trap. She told me about her Uncle Willie's scars over pudding. He was stabbed in Glasgow and his scars all over his back, his stomach, his leg, and part of his right ear was hacked off. And then there's the masterpiece, a 3-inch scar right around his wrist. Amma shakes her head, smiling. He wears that scar like a Rolex he isn't ever taken off, no, until his dying day. I was 29 when I met Amma, and I'd felt numb my whole life. I never thought anyone could change that, but she did. She's like that. There's always a lot Amma can do. You need a room painted nice, she paints nice. You need someone help you with something makes most people sick, call her. Nothing can make that girl vomit. You want to talk about them Greek weirdos with the big thoughts? She'll pontificate philosophy till the cows come home. You want to tell someone about something bad and dirty and not feel dumb? Amma'll make you a cup of tea. She only has one friend. One's all I need, she says. What about when Mick dies, I ask her. just won't see him for a while, she says. She reckons if she needs people again, she'll go out and find some. Plenty of them out there, she states. Amma says the trees are her friends, the ocean, the stars, the sand, the sky, the soup she cooks and the bread she bakes and the films she cries to with a big smile on her face. My love is enough, she reckons. You're broke as fuck, I tell her. Nah, she says, I just got lucky that way. We wait until nightfall. She gets the wheelbarrow, puts a duvet in it, two pillows, lifts me under the arms. I've had my extra morphine. I feel pretty good, all in all. Amma wheels me at the back, and the night smells clean and sharp. The stars are so beautiful, so bright and cold-looking. It makes me feel breathless. I can smell grass and wild garlic and flowers. The scents are crisp, like the cold air is preserving them. Amma holds my hand, sits down on an old deck chair. I pull the duvet tight. She hands me a box of matches. I strike a big one and launch it at the bonfire. Whoosh! It purrs and pops right away. The flames crackle and little sparks fly up. And the leg begins to sizzle, perched there on the top like a fucked bit of meat. And the foot, that foot does not even look like it should be there with its painted nails all shining blackly in the flames. I give it a hard, bloody whack with a stick. Amma strokes my hand real gentle, and I want to kiss her again. I only need what I need. What I need is all I need. I don't need that limb. I don't. What's weird is that piece of dead flesh burning like a fucking barbecue. It doesn't seem like anything to do with me. My left foot, my left limb. It feels like it's still attached to me, but it's not. It's not, and somehow, I just don't care. The fire spits a huge big bit of fat out, and we both recoil, startled for a second. Fucking hell, that's the last time you help out in the garden, Amma says. And I giggle. It begins with a shaking in my stomach, up my spine. I can feel her shaking too, her mouth open, silently helpless with laughter. The moon stares down in a silent O, and the old willow trees at the bottom of the garden swishes to and fro, to and fro.
Thanks to Jenny Fagan, and thanks to her especially for being really cool under adverse recording circumstances. Her book, The Panopticon, is available everywhere. You're going to want to read it. Everybody's talking about her. She was just featured in the New York Times. And again, congratulations to her for being featured on the granted list. You know, it's a big deal, and it was really great to hear about it. Lastly on the podcast, we're going to stay outside, but we're going to look into the sky. We sat down with Mark Thompson. You might know him as the host of Stargazing Live on the BBC, but he's also written a book called A Down-to-Earth Guide to the Cosmos. Here he is talking a little bit about astronomy and why we should pay a little bit more attention to what's above us. Let's talk about a little bit about just the book that you released, which I guess was based on Stargaze Live. It's called A Down-to-Earth Guide to the Cosmos.
Yes, exactly. And so it was. I wanted to do something that was different. There's lots of good books about astrophysics or how the universe works. There's lots of good books that show you how you find your way around the sky, but there's nothing that kind of brings the two together. So what I want to do is take those two very useful topics and actually merge them into one book. So whilst I'm teaching people how to find the way around the sky, I'm actually teaching them how the universe works at the same time.
There's kind of a month-by-month chart of how the sky looks in both hemispheres.
Yeah, so what I've done, I've taken a topic in each chapter. So, for example, the life cycle of stars, and then the second and third sections of that same chapter take the life cycle of stars and show you how you can illustrate that in the sky that month. So, you know, it might look at the January sky and it shows you all the different stars in that sky at different stages of their life. So it can, you actually build up an image and an understanding of how stars evolve by looking at the sky yourself.
Do you remember how you kind of started looking up?
Yeah, I was about 10 years old, so almost 30 years ago now. My dad took me to my local astronomy society. I saw Saturn through a telescope, and it looked absolutely stunning. And it was that image that caught my imagination and just fired my interest in the universe. And I've been working and loving it ever since.
Where did you start off? What was your kind of career trajectory?
I took probably quite a different route because I didn't go into it as a career. I didn't really study it in education. I finished school, had GCSEs, left school, wanted to earn money, perhaps a bit materialistically, but I wanted to earn money. So I got out into the world of work. Astronomy was a hobby for me. Since then, I worked in photography. I worked in IT. I worked in project management. I even, a few years back, trained to be an airline pilot and was planning to do that, but I got a break working on the One Show, doing some astronomy films on the One Show, and I got into media work and ultimately writing through that route. So for me, it was, you know, it was absolutely about being at the right place at the right time. But for anyone who is interested, it's all, you know, if kids are interested and want to get into astronomy for a career, it's all about mathematics and science. And, you know, really that's where it comes from. Science can actually be more generic. There's lots of physics, obviously, in astronomy, but of course geology, if you're looking at planetary surfaces, chemistry comes into it a lot as well, and even biology, if you're looking for, you know, for extraterrestrial life, you know. So all the different sciences can actually lead you down the route of studying the universe.
Do you ever still have yourself surprised, and how do you condense that to something that, like, normal people can understand? Because you must have a huge amount of mind-blowing knowledge to impart.
I like to think so. The universe is a huge, complex place, certainly, and there's lots of stuff. And yes, I am constantly having my mind blown. I mean, just recently we discovered a particular type of water on the surface of Mars, you know, and whilst we knew there was water there, it was a different type of water. We've since discovered water that's actually quite conducive to life to evolve. So discoveries like that, I mean, whilst it's not necessarily about big numbers, you know, actually on Mars at one point, it was conceivable that life could have evolved. Now, I mean, that is a seriously mind-blowing discovery. So, yes, it is, but I think as far as communicating it to people, there are really just almost a few key facts and a few key points. There's lots of fancy stuff around the outside, lots of really hardcore mathematics, but it's about stripping out all of that and just going for the key message, and it's about getting that over to people, I think, which communicates it well.
And that key message is?
That the universe is an amazing place, but you've just got to look up to enjoy it.
The universe is an amazing place. And that's kind of an amazing place to end a podcast. Thanks to Mark Thompson. You can get his book, A Down-to-Earth Guide to the Cosmos, everywhere. Also, thanks to our amazing contributors, Jenny Fagan and Kirsty Gunn. Check out their work. I know you want to read it if you haven't already. If you like our podcast, you can like us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter at ScottishBKTrust. Thanks so much for listening. It's been a real pleasure to be in your ears. We'll be back next month with more bookmarked action. Goodbye now. Bookmarked is produced by Colin Fraser with music from Ragland.
Thanks for listening to this Scottish Book Trust podcast. Find more book lists, stories, and interview blogs at scottishbooktrust.com. And connect with us on Facebook and Twitter.